Stephen Edwin King is an American author of horror, supernatural fiction, suspense, crime, science fiction, and fantasy novels. His books have sold more than 350 million copies, and many have been adapted into films, television series, miniseries, and comic books. Check the link in the description below to get his top books in audiobook format for free.
Hello, welcome. I'm Bridget Marshall. I'm the Associate Chair of the English Department, and I'm delighted that you all are here packing this room for a writer. Yes, words on a page. I want to take a brief moment, make sure your cell phone and beepy things are off. Mr. King has said that photos are fine, so if you want to be taking photos, that's all right. But please just make sure you're not going to be that person who embarrasses themselves with that ringtone that you made up that you thought was really cool. We don't need to hear that. We do need to make a couple of thank yous, first of all, to the administration and the chancellor, who is right back here as well, for everything you've done for the English department. It's been an exciting year of tons of great events, and we're so delighted to be a part of the first, the inaugural Chancellor Speaker Series here on campus. So I was going to tell you what the format of the talk would be, and we had this very elaborate arrangement of, oh, Andre would suggest that my colleague Andre Debuse, who is also here, would give you a prompt, Mr. King, and you would talk about it. But then I watched the two of them talking in the green room before, and they're just going to go. They're just going to go and keep talking and have lots to say. So it's going to be wonderful, is what you're in for. By way of very brief introduction, for Christmas in 1987, I received the greatest gift, the thing that I wanted most in the world, which was a giant stack of Stephen King novels. All Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, Cujo, Pet Sematary, all of it right there, all at once. And the terror I'm feeling right now is sort of the combination of all of those books tied together and just all around me. And I'm slightly worried that I may projectile vomit all over you all in the scene from the body. It's a real possibility, front row, so be careful. On Christmas Day 1987, as a 13-year-old, I opened Misery and didn't stop reading for the whole day. My mother was calling me, come celebrate, let's have Christmas dinner. No, was not having it. I was going to read Misery. And it's this power to transfix, to hold you really, really tight in the pages of a book that I don't think anyone does better. So we are so delighted. Please join me in welcoming my colleague Andre Debuse and Mr. Stephen King.
Wear your jacket.
This is Stevie King.
He had a costume.
He's wicked smart.
I'm not that smart. I wasn't smart enough to keep from wearing this mic. So I'm not sure what this particular mic is for, because you can hear me, right? I get one of these things, and I always want to do the Vegas thing, you know, Wayne Newton. Don Cashane. I'll just choke the fucker. So listen, are you writing students? Are you reading students? Are you lit guys? Are you writing?
How many creative writing concentrators?
Uh-huh.
How
uh-huh.
many flat English majors? How many lit majors? How many people just want to see Stephen King?
There you go. Well, I remember the first time I saw a real live writer. I was a freshman at the University of Maine, and Joseph Heller came to campus to talk about Catch 22. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm breathing the same air as the guy who thought up Yossarian and Major Major and all those things, you know, because I was just in love with reading. I was in love with my girlfriend, but sometimes, you know, if I'd been given a choice, it would have been, if they said, you can have your girlfriend or you can have books, I'd have to sit down and say, let me think about that. And that's the time, you know, you're at your most totally involved with somebody else that you're in love with. So, but I remember that, and I was very just sort of flabbergasted with amazement that that guy was there. And I remember he was wearing this beautiful suit. It was like a Wall Street guy's suit. And I was thinking, Jesus, he doesn't really look like a writer, but he was. And after he talked for a while, I realized he was just a guy. He was like Andre here, you know, somebody. So anyway, I'm just a guy, and I'm here to answer your questions and talk about what you want to talk about. There are certain questions that I'm asked a lot. People will say, which of the movies that were made out of your books do you like? They'll ask me, well, probably the most common one is, where do you get your ideas? And it's, to me, if you ask me that specifically, I can tell you about 50% of the time where I got the ideas. And the rest of it is totally, it's like getting an idea in a dream. And I can't really remember where they came from. Sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. But to talk a little bit about the process, the way that it works for me, and it might not work that way for you, but this is the way it works for me. I want to talk a little bit about what I'm working on now, which is a novel that's about three quarters done. And if I'm very, very lucky, it will get finished. But no, man.
By Tuesday.
Because, no, actually, I'd love to get it done by the end of the year. And I'm really driving on this thing now. And once I start to really drive, it usually goes fairly fast. But I never know if a book's going to get done until it's done, because I don't plot. I don't keep much in the way of notes, probably more than I used to because I'm older, and that's what happens. Your gears start to slip a little bit. But one of the worst things that I ever heard, for me personally, was I did something with John Irving one time, and he said that when he's starting a book, the first thing he does is write the last line. And I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, that's like eating the frosting off your cake and then eating your cake. I just, to me, I didn't see it. But he knows everything that's going to happen. And I know, really, fuck all what's going to happen. I'm telling you the truth there. But here's the way this works for me. When I was driving up from Florida to Maine last year, because I always drive back and forth, I stopped the first night in South Carolina, and I stayed at a motel, Motel 6 or something like that, and you know, there's really not anything to do there but turn on the TV and kick back and watch the local news and whatever else happens to be on. So I turned on the TV and there was the local news, and they had this story. And the story was about something that had happened at a McDonald's. The McDonald's, you know, this was like a year ago. The economy is still really just absolutely wretched. And so McDonald's announced that they were hiring in this town. It might have been Charleston. I'm not sure. But all these people turned up. There were like 1,000 people that turned up to apply for jobs. And there was one woman in this bunch of people that was waiting to try to get a job who had had a fight with another woman the day before. The first woman was married to this guy. She caught the woman who was applying for a job in McDonald's in bed with her husband. She got wicked pissed. And she decided that she was going to confront this woman, you know, and basically rip her hair off if that was possible. So she got in her car, she found out that the woman was applying for a job at McDonald's, and she drove there, and she got out of the car, pushed her way through all these job applicants and grabbed this woman and started to shake her. They had a fight. The woman who was applying for a job broke away and disappeared into the car, into the crowd. So the woman who had come there got back into her car, put it in gear, and drove into the job seekers. They just went everywhere. There was cell phone footage of it. She got the woman, pasted her a couple of good ones, got back into her car, threw it in reverse, and backed over a bunch more people on her way out. Well, two people were killed. And I thought to myself, I want to write about this. I didn't know why I wanted to write about it or what I wanted to write about it. I just knew that I wanted to write about it. Now, some people, when I'm in a group like this, and I'm not going to stand behind this goddamn lectern the whole time because it feels weird, like a presidential debate or something. But people will say, do you keep a notebook? And the answer is, I think a writer's notebook is the best way in the world to immortalize bad ideas. my idea about a good idea is one that sticks around and sticks around and sticks around. It's like, to me, it's like if you were to put breadcrumbs in a strainer and shake it, which is what the passage of time is for me. It's like shaking a strainer. All this stuff that's not very big and not very important just kind of dissolves and falls out. But the good stuff stays. You know, the big pieces stay. I had the idea for Under the Dome when I was teaching high school back in 1973, and it was just too big for me, and I was too young for it. And I wrote about 25, 26 pages and put it away. There's a scene at the beginning of this book where this woodchuck gets cut in half when this dome comes down over this town. I had written that part when I was in my early 20s and just sort of recreated it from memory when I wrote the book. So the good stuff stays. So I saw this thing and I wanted to write about it. And this goes to, the only reason I'm even talking about this is because Andre was saying, when you wrote Townie, you started to write about baseball, and it just sort of grew. Well, this thing stuck around, and then my method for starting anything is I tell myself the story when I'm laying in bed at night before I go to sleep. I'll tell myself this story. And so at some point, probably 9 months after this, because this is what it's like, you know, a little piece of grit and it makes a pearl after a while. You just have to give it time, and if it doesn't happen, it doesn't, but a lot of times it does. So about 9 months after that, I thought, well, what if a guy did this and did it on purpose, and he killed a bunch of people, and what if there was a detective that was sort of at the end of his working career, and this was like a detective who'd had a lot of success with a lot of cases, but he didn't have time to do much with this one because of mandatory retirement. So what if, after a while, the guy who did it wrote him a letter and said, I did it. I'm really glad I did it. I enjoyed the screams. I heard their bones breaking as this car went over them. I just absolutely adored the whole experience of killing all these people. The blood went up on the windshield. The headlights broke. You know, I was wearing a mask, so I knew that they wouldn't know who I was. I didn't know if I would get away with it, but I did. I did, and it was great. And here's the thing, this guy's saying in this letter. A lot of times, guys like me, they do something like this, and if the cops don't catch him right away, they say, well, wait, he'll try to do it again, and we'll catch him then. But guess what? I don't want to do it again. Once was enough. I just relive the memories, and, you know, it's a really... I was working this letter over in my mind. It's a really nasty piece of work, you know. But the thing was, what made it nasty, this thing's all tied down. Come on. Jesus Christ, what fun is that? So what I'm thinking is the cop, you know, this thing about blue suicide and cops retire and they get, you know, they don't have anything else to do and yeah. A lot of them eat their own gun. And I thought, here's this cop who's sitting in his house, and he gets this letter about 6 months after he's retired, and the only thing he's done is watch daytime TV, you know, like Judge Judy and Dr. Phil. I mean, that would drive me to suicide right there. So Oh, yeah, you laugh like you never fucking watched those shows. Right? We're all too good for that, aren't we? That's right. You know what I did? I got in about 11 o'clock to this thing, and the first thing I did was turn on The Price is Right. Okay, and I got just in time for the big jackpot thing at the end, and I'm guessing right along with them. So I'm no better, and I don't pretend to be. But anyway, I thought to myself, this is going to be a short story. That's the only thing I was thinking is, I'm going to tell it in the present tense. It's going to be this cop. He's going to get this letter. He's going to realize he can never solve this. And at the end of the letter, which I was going to save for the end, the guy was going to say, I know you've still got your service weapon. You're never going to catch me, so you might as well use it. And I wanted to end the story with the guy putting the gun into his mouth. So now, instead of a 12-page story, I've got a 500-page manuscript. Because the thing just grew. And that's the way it works for me. I don't try to force them to be anything that they don't want to be. So, having said that and warmed up the crowd so that you know that I'm just pretty much a regular guy,
can I just say I'm a little disturbed by how into it he got when he described all the blood and guts.
That's what I do. And I think, you know, a lot of times when people come to see me, they want to see if I'm really fucked up. You know? Here's the thing, okay? A lot of times, if you're recording all this, you're going to have to bleep it because I have to be who I am. A lot of times, you know, when I do these interviews, they'll ask you questions and they'll say, what was your childhood like? And I no longer brook that question. I just tell the interviewer, what you want to know is what traumatized me so badly that I write this creepy shit. The answer is nothing. Nothing that I remember anyway, but of course, I wouldn't tell you anyway.
Who has a question for Mr. King? Oh, nobody.
Great. Yeah.
I was wondering, like, obviously you're best known for your books, but mm-hmm. you've obviously had written a lot of original screenplays and had parts in adapting a movie. So I was wondering what the difference is in your approach to writing entertaining books and entertaining screenplays. Good question.
Well, I didn't used to take screenplay writing as seriously as I came to later. In fact, I was even on record saying that screenplay was work for idiots. And believe me, I've seen a lot of screenplays that were written by idiots. And I'm talking about guys that can't spell or write a sentence. And they can't write dialogue either. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Right?
I do.
So the real...
And they make a lot of money not writing good dialogue, by the way.
They do. Some of them do. But the real difference is that everything in a movie is on the surface, okay? I had a lot of trouble over a lot of years, and I love them. This is coming from somebody who loves the movies. And one of the reasons that so many of my books have been turned into movies is because my creative sense was formed by visual imagery before it was the books. And I think that's true of almost everybody now, but I was one of the first writers that broke through from my generation that watched Bambi and you know, a lot of other movies on TV and everything before I was able to read even, you know. So I learned that visual medium. And once I fell in love with books, I fell in love completely. And for a long time, I felt like movies were a lesser medium because it's like skating. It's all on the surface. Every now and then, some movie will be reduced to doing a voiceover, you know, where this character is talking, and I just kind of
go, to get the interior life.
Yeah. And I just kind of go, no, you've clearly mistaken this medium for something that it's not. But I came to realize that films have a language of their own, and you have to learn that language, and it isn't enough to say, well, I've watched movies my whole life. You have to write a couple. I started... I think I was probably, I'd been writing novels full time for about a year and a half, and I thought to myself, I want to learn how to write movies. I want to try it anyway. So I got a book that was about writing screenplays, and I read it, and it was bullshit, but at the end, it had a sample screenplay from The Twilight Zone. that showed me what the form was. And that wasn't bullshit. That was something real that I could, that I could. So I took the Ray Bradbury book, Something Wicked This Way Comes, and I wrote a screenplay, and I learned what I was doing. It wasn't for anybody but me. And then a little while later, I wrote a book called The Shining, and it was my third book, and I got contractual rights to write the first draft screenplay for that. And I did do that, and I found out later that Stanley Kubrick, who had got the rights through Warner Brothers, had already determined that he and a lady named Diane Johnson were going to do the screenplay for The Shining. So they basically, my screenplay went in and they said, no, this won't do, and then they went on to what they really wanted to do, which was fine. I wasn't angry or upset. You're not. After a while, you get thousands of rejection slips before you break through. You kind of get used to that, and it's just part of the game. But the thing is, you learn. You learn little by little. So there's a difference. I sometimes think it's more strict. The differences are more strict and the discipline is tighter when you write for TV, because particularly with serialized TV, there's a certain build. It's almost like it's stylized almost, where you build to a certain level, and then there's either a commercial break or an episode break, and it goes back down. Do any of you watch Breaking Bad, Mad Men, maybe Walking Dead, that sort of thing? It's the same thing. There's a build to a climax, and then you go back down, but you never go back down as far, and you start to build up again.
Somebody? Another question.
Yeah, ma'am.
This is a little bit random, but I have family in Canada, so we drive through Bangor, Maine every year.
Yeah.
And I just always personally wondered if Maximum Overdrive was influenced by Dysart's restaurant.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
You know, did you guys hear the question? Was Maximum Overdrive influenced by Dysart Restaurant in Bangor, Maine?
Dysart's truck stop, we grew up calling it Dry Farts. but it's, you know, just one of those things. It really isn't that bad. I mean, it's body gasoline. You go in there, gas up your truck. Or we used to get, when we were in college, we'd all get a few drinks in us. Of course, none of us smoked marijuana. But sometimes,
ever.
Sometimes we would pretend we had smoked marijuana and get the munchies, and we'd go to Dysart's, and the trucks would go in and out. So yeah, two away. You'll never get me to admit that. So yes, it was Dysart's.
Cool.
Yeah. I'm going to get to the back here in a minute, too. No, because...
Let me repeat. The question is, in The Shining, Dr. Sleep has got Danny Torrance, continued from The Shining as a character. And your question was, does Stephen's son, Joe Hill, the writer, did influence Stephen's writing of Danny Torrance in the Dr. Sleep?
The answer is no. Danny Torrance in The Shining is like 4 years old, 5 years old, something like that. And at that time, I wrote a lot about little kids because I had little kids, and I had a chance to observe them in their natural habitat, you know, as they went about their zoological functions of feeding, eating, shitting in their diapers, and everything else. I knew exactly. I was very much into that, and I was very much in love with my kids. And so it was natural for me and very easy for me to write about Danny as a four-year-old, a bright four-year-old. But also, when I want the idea for a sequel to The Shining has kicked around in my head for a long time. And for a long time I resisted it, because the way that The Shining is remembered is this amazingly scary novel, you know, about the people caught in the hotel. And I think sometimes you catch a vibe like that once, and I also think that people remember a story like that because, like, they were 14 years old and they read it at summer camp, and it scared the living shit right out of them, you know. And they're thinking, oh man, that book was really scary. And then they kind of grow up, they get case hardened, they've seen, you know, Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and all these other Alien, everything, and not to mention Kubrick's version of The Shining. And you grow up and you say, God, that book was so scary. Well, maybe if you read it as an adult, you know, as an 18-year-old or a 22-year-old, you wouldn't be as scared because you wouldn't be quite so open and the experience of horror itself wouldn't be quite so new. So my thing about writing a sequel, and I think this is true for a lot of books, the one big exception where people always look at the sequel as the classic rather than the original is Huckleberry Finn. Right?
That's right.
Huckleberry Finn is a sequel to Tom Sawyer.
That's right. And it's a better book.
Everybody says it is, and I guess it is, but I always love
it. I say
Tom
so,
Sawyer.
Steve.
Okay. Andre says so, it's true. Because he's my ride back tonight. Anyway, the thing that interested me about The Shining is that there are so many kids that grow up with that kind of alcoholic, abusive parent who become that parent themselves. And it interested me that Jack Torrance in the book, The Shining, is a guy who remembers his father with both love and horror, and he's determined that he will never replicate that behavior. And then that's what he does. He replicates his father's behavior. And now, when I wrote the book, there's a term now that doesn't exist, and that term is codependent. Okay, a codependent is somebody, the best way to describe it is if you're a codependent and you're drowning, someone else's life flashes before your eyes. Well, obviously he's had a few, you know. Probably had quite a few at one time or another.
I'm not saying a word.
Stick around, guys. We'll be here all week. So what I wanted to do was I wanted Danny to replicate his father's behavior, and I wanted to see what he was like as an adult. And the other thing was I wanted to kind of go up against that idea that a sequel is usually the last resort of the failing writer. So I wanted to go in there and see if I could write a book that was as scary. I don't think it is as scary, but I think it's scary. I hope it is.
That's great.
What about way in the back? That guy right there in the black, yeah.
Do you guys hear that?
Pen and paper as opposed to word processing. I work on a computer now because it's faster. I really like it. I heard a story about the writer Stanley Elkin, who was a wonderful novelist. He wrote The Dick Gibson Show and a bunch of other books, and he had cerebral palsy. And this was before computers, and things went along, and computers came into vogue, word processing programs, and my first word processor was a Wang word processor, and people would call for me, and my wife would pick up the phone. They'd say, "Can I talk to Steve?" And she'd say, "No, he's upstairs pounding his big Wang." She used to say that. She used to say that. But those were the days when you got the floppy disks that were as big as albums, you know, and you stuck them in the machine, and sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. But the point is, when Elkin got this machine finally, it was given to him. Everybody in his English department clubbed together and got enough money to get him one of these machines. And he said that if he had had one when he was 26, he would have written 7 more books. And those would have been invaluable books to have. So I still write longhand. I've still got yellow pads. And I write longhand when there's nothing else at hand. And if I do have to make notes, I always make them longhand. So that's the answer to that. I mean, in the end, everything goes back to the computer in the sense that it gets plugged into the, even everything in handwritten is first draft. So that's that. I can put this on.
Wait a minute. You, the first draft is handwritten?
No. Sometimes it is. If I don't, is this on? Hello? Hello. That's really...
Is this one on too? I have to tell you might not remember this. So my novel, Garden Last Days, which he reviewed really beautifully in the Entertainment Tonight, which helped me a lot.
It's a terrific book.
Thank you. Well, I sent him an email.
I'm not just saying that because he's my ride back.
We were emailing each other. I said, "Hey, oh, Steve, I just, 5.5 years, I finished this 800-page novel." He wrote back, "Yo, Andre, A-N-D-R-A-Y. Yo, Andre, I, too, have an 800-page manuscript on my desk, but it took me 6 months, not 5 years.
I never said
yes,
that.
Yes, well, you know, you did it with tongue-in-cheek. But and you know what? You were being generous, because it probably took 3 months.
Well, there was one book, The Running Man, which was made into a really awful movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But I was teaching high school at that time, and it was February vacation, so I wrote that one in a week. But I'm not alone in that. I mean, it was short.
Another questione.
This lady right here in the orange.
Okay. So you've obviously scared a lot of people with your writing. This is kind of a personal question, but how do you feel about people who are scared of people, and what scares you?
How does it make you feel knowing you've scared so many people, and what scares you?
I love it to scare people. Obviously, because I've done a lot, and I never set out to do that per se. People will say, do you mind if I call you a horror writer? And my response is, you can call me whatever you want, as long as I can do whatever it is that I'm doing and continue to feed my family and pay for the heating oil and that sort of thing. That's great. So you can call me whatever you want to. But what I am is sort of a I'm more interested. I think that any book should bear up to two readings, okay? Particularly, there are certain books that are very, very emotionally hot, and that's the kind of writing that I do. I'm a confrontational writer. I want to be in your face. I want to get into your space, you know? I want to get within kissing distance, hugging distance, choking distance, punching distance, call it whatever you want. But I want your attention, you know? It's like, I didn't come here for cocktail hour. I don't look at writing that way. I look at it as a very important, vital, muscular deal. And I can remember, and I've talked about this before, and you may have read it, and if you have, I don't mean to bore you, but the first book that really turned my dials all the way was Lord of the Flies by William Golding. And that was a book I read when I was 13 or 14, and it became the most important thing in my life for 2 or 3 days. Whether or not that boy Jack was going to survive the other boys on that island or not, okay? That's all it was for me, was that story. And it took over my life. Meals were not important. My games with my friends weren't important. Nothing was important. I had to know what happened. It was vital that I know that. So I read it. I was white hot. I was not, when you read that way, you're not in an intellectual frame of mind. You're not analyzing it. You're not doing it for a class. You know, sometimes I get letters from people saying they won't let our teacher teach your book in class. You know, if it's in high school, my reaction is fucking great. Good. Go read it yourself and make up your own analysis of it. Get it outside of class. You know, if it matters to you, it matters. And that's great. I think books are sometimes better when you know that you're not going to be graded and you're not going to have to deal with that at all. So that's the way that I read in Lord of the Flies. And then I read the afterword of Lord of the Flies. You know, the story is about these boys on this island. Their plane crashes. Apparently there's been a nuclear war. And they descend into savagery from being English schoolboys who were part of a choir. They descend into utter savagery, and at the end of the book, they're hunting down one of their own who won't get with the program, and it's clear that what they're going to do is ritually kill him to pacify the gods, more or less. So they've reverted completely to a lack of civilization. And at the very end of the book, and I'm going to tell you this whether you've read it or not, because all that spoiler shit is for wusses, okay? spoilers ahead, spoilers ahead. Ah, screw it. You know, if you don't want a spoiler, don't read the goddamn piece, and you can go like this right now if you want to. La, 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 I can't hear you. But what happens at the end of the book is that a sub surfaces, and so sailors from the British Navy show up, and they save this kid at the last minute. And the guy who's commanding the expedition says, well, I would have thought English schoolboys would put on a better show. like that. And that's kind of where it's left. And Golding writes in his afterword, and I never forgot this, he says, the sailors save the boys, but who will save the sailors? Because this takes place after a nuclear war, and it kind of like opened my eyes, and I thought, wait a minute, there's a whole other level to this story right here. And once you know that Jack is saved and things turn out a certain way, I was able to go back to the book and read it with the front of my brain, the cool part of my brain, and appreciate it on an intellectual level. That's why I say any good books, you should be able to read it twice. The first time, what I want from you is your total attention, and I want you to be engaged, and I don't want you to be analyzing. I don't want you to be thinking about the language. I don't want you to see me at all. I don't want to be part of that equation. But if you come back to it again, I'd like to think that there would be something else as well, other than that emotional hit, that emotional jag, that roller coaster e-ticket ride. There ought to be a little more than that, because like a book like The Shining, I spent a year on that thing, a year of my life. It ought to be about something, you know? So what else?
What scares you, Mr. King? You didn't answer that part.
Oh, what scares me? Everything. Everything scares me.
Everything.
Spiders, snakes, death, my mother-in-law. Mother-in-law jokes are always good, aren't they? But hey, I outlived her, so yes, ma'am.
Good question, Marissa. Have you ever had the desire to write something out of character for you under a pseudonym just to see how it would be received if people didn't know Stephen King wrote it?
Yeah. It reminds me of a story about the Beatles at the height of the Beatlemania craze, where Paul McCartney came. You know, they couldn't go anywhere. And when they played, like when they played at Shea Stadium, nobody could hear the music because everybody was screaming so loud. And Paul McCartney went to John Lennon one day and said, have you ever thought that we could play a few shows as the Masked Bandits, and we would go on stage and we'd be wearing masks and we'd play clubs, nobody would know who we were, and we could see if we could, you know, put a show across that way? And Lennon laughed and said, after five notes, they'd know who we were. And that's the thing about once you've published a number of books, there's a kind of a face print, there's a fingerprint, there's a whole personality thing. Now there's a machine, I think they have it at Vassar, where they can plug in a number of books, even if they don't know who it is. This machine's got all these syntactical clues and everything, so the machine can say with a fair degree of accuracy who wrote what. And I know that I have certain little stylistic tics, but every time that I write, I try to say things in a different way. I mean, or try something new. I don't want to dig a rut and furnish it, if I can help it. You have to try to challenge yourself a little bit. And the new book, the one that I told you about, is more of a mystery novel than anything else, and it doesn't have any supernatural elements. So something different for me, and it's really tough, but that's good. That's good. I don't want to phone it in if I can help it. Let's see. There's a guy back there in brown. Sort of
Philip.
Like, yeah, Philip. Philip, I knew that was you, Philip.
That's Phil.
Randall Flagg is always around. He's like this spirit of evil that first shows up in The Stand. Oh, well, yes, to the world, he first shows up in The Stand, but I wrote a poem called The Dark Man when I was in college. I think I was probably a sophomore, so I would have been like 20. And I wrote it on a napkin in a restaurant, you know. And I held on to that, and when it came time to write The Stand, I said, this is what I was thinking about, this guy who is like an embodiment of everything that goes wrong with us, all the impulses, the bad feelings, every time, you know, that there's a quarrel and it goes beyond words and somebody gets hurt or somebody gets killed. And I wanted to embody that kind of mindless rage and anger, evil, if you like. I'm troubled by the question of evil, and I always have been, about whether it all comes from inside us, and if it does, why we're programmed that way to do really shitty things to each other, or if some of it comes from outside. And I've never been able to entirely solve the question. It's one that you certainly took up in the garden.
I will write him a check for that comment as soon as we're done. I have to share with you one of my favorite Tom Waits songs from his song, Line from Heart Attack and Vine, that addresses this thing directly. It says, there is no devil, there's just God when he's drunk. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's a great line.
They'll get you hung in Ohio to say that kind of thing. But.
Well, there's a lot about God and evil in this book that I'm working on. It's called Mr. Mercedes. And I think that we try to work these things out for ourselves. Certainly, one of the things that drove you when you wrote the book about the terrorists had to be the fact that these guys thought they were going to heaven. They were doing a good thing. They were doing a good thing. So the whole idea, too, of religion as being sometimes the devil's tool. These are complex issues, and really they're difficult for me to discuss, because one of the reasons that I'm a writer is because when I try to express these things orally, I get my tang gets tangled up. Something else? Ma'am?
When you're writing fiction, what's your first name?
Maddie.
Hi, Maddie. She said, when you're writing fiction, how do you create character and how do you avoid creating same old character? Yeah. That's a hard one. Next question for Mr. King. Kidding. You write a lot about this in On Writing.
I think that the way that I would answer that is, first of all, you start with the idea that for most of us, we think that we're good guys. We think we're the good guys. We think we're on the side of angels. And so my idea is everybody has some part of their character that's admirable. I'm sure that at one time or another, Theodore Bundy helped an old lady across the street. Of course, he probably raped and murdered her on the other side, but that's what I'm talking about. That's the yin and yang of it. So I have a tendency to start totally unjudgmental. That's part of the benefit of working story rather than plot. Our lives develop naturally, and our characters develop naturally over a period of time, and they are influenced by a lot of different characteristics. And the way that we look at other people is influenced, too, over a period of time as we get to know them. Sometimes women that you didn't think were, you know, particularly good looking, you get to know them, the more you see them, the more you say, after a while you say, oh, that woman is pretty. And then a year or two later you say, that woman is really beautiful, but I didn't see that at first. Or you say, some guy, well, he's just a guy, and he sort of just somebody else that happened to be at this party or in this dorm or whatever, and you get to talk to those people a little bit, the personality starts to come forward and you start to see the shadows and the depth of things. I've got a character in Mr. Mercedes whose name is Holly Gibney, and I expected her to be a walk-on, okay? She's this 47-year-old woman who still lives with her aging mother, and she's got psychological problems, and she never speaks above a mumble. In fact, she's introduced in the book as Holly the Mumbler. because she's one of these people. We've seen this person. We've all seen this person. You can't really say what they're saying. You can't really hear what they're saying, and they have a tendency to sort of avoid eye contact. They might look up every now and then and say a little bit. They might have certain tics, habits. So I thought to myself, well, I've got a great line for this this lady. The first time that my main character meets her is at a Holiday Inn restaurant where he thinks she orders a sneezeburger. Because she speaks so low, she's actually ordering a cheeseburger. So I thought she was a walk-on. I thought she was a flat character. Little by little, she's become more and more important to me and more fun to write about. And I started to see that she has an interior life. And you begin by observing. You have to look. Raise your hand again if you're in the writing courses. You have to look. You have to see. I mean, you can't just walk and let it all go by. It's some of this has got to stay. You've got to see how people are. You've got to look for the person who, when they eat, they have a tendency to look down at their plate and they're tearing their napkins. Have you ever seen a napkin ripper? Okay? Or somebody who is in a cafeteria and they've kind of like got the straw in pieces. Holly is a lipstick biter, kind of like this all the time, kind of a, you know, she'll talk through her nails. So it's part of the fun of it to me, is to see better and see more.
Do you know that famous Flannery O'Connor line about this? She says, there's a certain grain of stupidity the writer can hardly do without.
Yep.
And that is the quality of having to stare.
Yeah.
So I mean, hearing you say for everybody is that when you create character, you're really fueled by curiosity, not answers.
That's right. You want to see them grow. And they do their own thing if you let them, if you let them do their own thing. And one of the things that drives me crazy about second and third rate fiction is when a writer will wind a character up and make them go through certain paces. And I think, oh, why don't you just go back and cut out paper dolls? Somebody over here, somebody, Bueller, in the back, yeah. Whichever one, somebody rude, ask a question.
You guys heard that, right? Good deep voice, brother. What's your name?
Tom.
You answer that one, Andre.
I think there's all kinds of hope for, will writing be dropped? Or is literature and writing and reading in danger, is what you're saying, because of the visual? I actually don't think it is. Let's just look at this. Steve and I were talking about this while he was listening to me tell him, because he's humble. People have flown from Europe to see him tonight. We have over 3,000 people coming to see a friggin' writer. I mean, this is, to me, this gives me such hope.
But it's not like being you too. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. My answer is I think there's all kinds of hope. I think the technology is changing. But for some reason, I think every human being is born, every generation is born. The soul needs stories. The soul will always need stories. I don't know why. And we're not going anywhere. Storytellers aren't going anywhere. And I don't think it's going anywhere. It's going to be different. It's going to be cyber stories and other weird stuff I hate, but I like books.
Well, I mean, reading is still popular. It's just a question of what you read. I mean, Twilight is huge. Those damn 50 Shades of Grey books were gigantic.
Garbage! Now, garbage! Sorry, did I just say that out loud?
No, that's okay. That's okay. And you know, It's like Anna. I read the first one, and it took me 3 months to read it. And you know, the funniest thing about the 50 Shades, how many of you read it? Be honest. Come on, raise your hands. Not very many of you.
Tyler, you read it?
Yeah. Same way. Tyler, you rock with your bad self right there. There's an honest man.
Steve, that guy's a wicked good actor, by the way, Mr. Tyler Puffin.
Love it.
Yeah.
The best parts of the 50 Shades of Grey book that I read was I thought the sex scenes were really good. And then somebody told me that in book two or book three, there's a scene that involves a jet ski and a butt plug. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not going there, man. That sounds like really uncomfortable. But anyway, you know, the thing is, the sex scenes are the best things in those books, but Anna, as a character, really only has two default positions. When something pleases her, she'll say, oh my. And when something's bad, she'll say, oh God. And it's just again and again and again. So, but the books, you know, were like something like 15, 16% of all trade hardcovers that were sold last year. So somebody out there is reading those puppies. A lot of people read the Harry Potter books. A lot of people read the Hunger Games books. A lot of people read my books. It's not on that level. Well, I'm not trying to say it is. A lot of people read James Patterson. But those things are not necessarily literature. There are books that are in the middle where you can go either way. And I sometimes think that people don't challenge themselves very hard to read stuff that's a little bit more textured or nuanced. You know, and then sometimes I think that the people who are defenders of what they call literature feel like a book has to be ignored if it reaches more than 750 readers. Yeah. So it's a difficult question, but reading, I have no doubt that reading will continue. It will read, Andre's right, it'll be in different markets. Yeah.
I hate to do this. It has to be just one more, I think, sadly.
Two more.
Let's do two.
Right here.
Nick asked, what are one of your favorite H.P. Lovecraft stories?
I like a lot of them. The best one for me is The Color Out of Space. But I like the Dunwich Horror. I like the Rats in the Walls. Those are great stories. There's one called Pickman's Model. It's a terrific story. After a while, I got to a point where I said, you know, basically, this guy can't write a scene. Everything was very static. But there was a time in my life when I thought Lovecraft was really terrific. I don't think that I had body hair at that point, but one more. You pick, Andre.
I'm going to pick Jillian.
Go, Jillian.
All right, Jack Beaumont and George Stark. Yeah, yes. You're yin and yang.
Yes, I would say probably, although my actual model, that was the dark half, and it's about this literary writer, Thad Beaumont, who has a crime writing alter ego, a pen name named George Stark. And when he tries to dump the Stark pen name, Stark actually comes to life and starts to stalk people to get Thad to write about him again. And I was kind of basing the idea on a writer who's now passed on named Donald Westlake, who wrote kind of lighthearted crime novels under his own name. And under the name Richard Stark, he wrote these cold-blooded novels about a thief named Parker. And some interviewer asked him one time what the difference was, and he said he wrote as Westlake on sunny days and as Richard Stark on days when it rained. So I even appropriated the line for the book. But I really wanted to write about the different people that we are. I've always wondered who I am when I write, because once I'm doing it, I'm not really in the room with myself. So. Listen, you guys have been great. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you coming.
Can I just say one thing? I want to introduce you. Chance Ramean is going to talk about this tonight, but I know a lot of you guys may not be at the thing at the Songest tonight. So I do want to say something about Steve King too. You know, he's donated his fee for the Stephen and Tabitha King Endowment to help future scholarships.
Yeah, that's
and
so if people
he
didn't
want me to say that out loud, but this is for free, baby. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. So,
I was just going to say, it's self-defense. So that if somebody comes up to me and says, you sucked, I can say, yes, but I sucked for free.
So someone in here has the chance to be the first Stephen King scholar in our department next year because of this scholarship. So thank you, Mr. King. We have a couple of things for you.
You shouldn't have.
So you can wear that sometime when you're gardening.
Nice.
We have the light blue one, but we thought gray would be better for you.
Gray's better for me, yeah.
So also...
Matches my hair.
You may not know that it's Stephen King. There is a bobblehead of Stephen King. Okay.
The Lowell Spinners.
So, yeah, and we also sponsored a Jack Kerouac bobble set, so now you have a play set. We have a Jack Kerouac bobblehead that you can use with your other bobblehead. This one has a bobbling thumb.
It's great. I can think of some things I can do with this. On a jet ski.
But anyway, thank you all for being here, and thank you, Mr. King,
We have another screening here. We have Carol Astor from the bottom. That one's pretty cool.
So, all right.
Thanks again.
We'll see you in a minute.
Stephen Edwin King is an American author of horror, supernatural fiction, suspense, crime, science fiction, and fantasy novels. His books have sold more than 350 million copies, and many have been adapted into films, television series, miniseries, and comic books. Check the link in the description below to get his top books in audiobook format for free.